For Joe Public Media, I'm Tom Jackson, and I will be talking today with Professor Michael Mello, who is an authority on the death penalty. In the past few weeks, the death penalty has been discussed in the media and publicly at a level not seen for quite some time. The execution in California of Tukey Williams was protested by many, and Kenneth Lee Boyd became the 1,000th person to be executed in the United States since the death penalty was reinstated back in 1976. Joining us today to talk about the death penalty is Professor Michael Mello. He teaches at Vermont Law School, and he's a specialist on the death penalty and has served as counselor at law on more than 50 capital punishment cases, including some very high-profile cases. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Start off, if you would, by telling us about some of the cases that you've worked on.
Well, back in my youth, when I was a capital public defender in Florida during the early mid-1980s, I represented Ted Bundy, the fairly infamous accused serial killer. I was also involved, although I didn't actually represent Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And I've been involved in one court or another in most of the interesting and landmark capital punishment issues. I filed a friend of the court brief, for example, last year in Roper v. Simmons, the case where the U.S. Supreme Court this last March outlawed capital punishment for juvenile offenders. I was also the point person in Florida for litigating claims of race discrimination based on social science data, statistical data. So in all, probably around 70 cases, give or take.
Do you ever get the question, this is a little bit of an aside, but do you ever get the question, how can you defend these people? And if so, what's your response to that?
I get that question all the time. It's a question that I've been getting since I first started doing death penalty work, which actually started during my judicial clerkship from the summer of 82 to the summer of 83, when I clerked for a federal court of appeals judge named Robert Vance in Birmingham, Alabama. And there, I wasn't representing death row prisoners, but I was Judge Vance's death clerk, his phrase, which I've always found somewhat delicious. Then the question was, how can you even work on these cases as a law clerk? And I never really came up with a good, pithy, cocktail party conversation patter answer. The standard answer is that everyone, no matter how hideous, no matter what they've done, deserves a good lawyer, deserves their day in court. It's the American way. That answer has never really been entirely satisfactory to me, because it doesn't really answer the question, well, why you? I mean, why have you chosen to devote your professional life to representing people who commit the worst, most horrific crimes in America? And for me, it really happened by accident, if one believes in accidents. As I mentioned, I ended up being Judge Vance's death clerk for the year that I clerked in Alabama. And towards the end of my clerkship, I decided that it would be good to spend a year or so, and that's really all I planned on doing, spending a year or so representing death row prisoners in Florida to, honestly, to expiate some of the liberal guilt that I had acquired during my clerkship with Judge Vance. I ended up having to being assigned to write an opinion, a first draft of an opinion for the judge, affirming the conviction and death sentence for a profoundly mentally retarded African-American indigent poor person pauper named Ivan Ray Stanley. And that's a case that I still have nightmares about. So I went to Florida, found out that I loved the work, loved the people I was working with, and with a couple of exceptions, liked my clients and got along very well with them. So a year became two, became three, became four. And after a couple of years in private practice in Washington, D.C., where I spent about a third of my time working on the firm's pro bono death penalty cases, I relocated up here to Vermont at Vermont Law School, and I've been writing and teaching capital punishment ever since.
Well, what's your take on a case that has been in the news a pretty fair amount the last month or so? Stanley Tukey Williams, founder of the Los Angeles-based gang, the Crips, convicted of murdering four people in California. Based on what you know about his case, do you think that he should have gotten clemency?
Clemency is one of those weird and really the last vestige of the divine right of kings. There are no standards. There are no guidance. No real guidelines. There's no judicial review. Governors can grant or decline or deny clemency based on whatever reason they want. Had I been governor of California, I would have granted clemency. I would have granted clemency to anyone whose case came before me, which is probably why I will probably never become governor of California or any other state. Williams was, in a lot of ways, a terrible case to become such a high-profile poster boy for capital punishment and clemency. He had done a lot of good things and good works during his time on death row, but even a lot of that was somewhat ambiguous and somewhat ambivalent, it always seemed to me. He never really took responsibility or admitted his guilt for the four murders for which he was executed. He never helped the police by providing information that might have been useful in closing other murder cases, in dismantling the Crips gang that he helped found. So on balance, for me, I never really thought that it was a terribly strong case for clemency. And I really don't know enough about the specifics of his trials or appeals to have an opinion on whether his trial was fair or whether he should have gotten a retrial. On its face, in my experience, if a capital case is clean enough to survive review by the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, as Williams was, then my guess is that there's not much fundamentally wrong with your case legally or constitutionally. The Ninth Circuit is widely and justifiably, for the most part, considered the most liberal and the most death row friendly circuit court in the country. So if they said that Tukey Williams' convictions and death sentences passed constitutional muster, my guess is that they probably did.
Well, going back to the if you were governor scenario for a second, you know, there was quite a reaction that came out, particularly in the progressive media, of people who are against the death penalty and or were against Tukey Williams being executed. There were lots of accusations that Governor Schwarzenegger you know, was playing politics, and that's why he didn't give Tukey Williams clemency. What's your take on that? Is that something that, you know, is politics something that's played when we're talking about ending a person's life in a case like this?
I do. And of all of the hats that I have worn over the years as a lawyer and an advocate for death row, clemency was the process that I liked the least because, precisely because it was so politically driven and driven by forces and factors external to and really having next to nothing to do with the underlying fairness of the conviction or the death sentence. It's interesting. Clemency in this country used to be a fairly robust institution up until the late 60s. And interestingly, the last governor to grant a clemency in California was Ronald Reagan back in 1967. Since then, clemency has virtually ceased to exist, except in those rare cases in which there really is a genuine doubt about guilt. Questions of innocence, issues of innocence, really have become the center of gravity in not just the challenges to individual cases and capital punishment in the courts, but in the larger political context as well. I had actually held out some hope that Schwarzenegger might relent and do the right thing, from my perspective, do the right thing in the Williams case, especially since he really seemed to be agonizing over it during the weekend. But at the end of the day, I think it would have been politically, I think, difficult for him to have granted clemency. For Schwarzenegger, given the fact that the voters of California just not surprising to me that he did, but it is a little disappointing. It would have been a great opportunity, I think, for him to do something based on principle that would have been unpopular among a good portion of his base, but which I think would have given him some real moral capital, which he might have been able to translate into political capital. But we'll never know because he wimped out.
Mm-hmm. Well, in another recent execution that got actually significantly less attention than Tukey Williams, execution number 1,000 since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976 just took place. Kenneth Lee Boyd was executed in North Carolina.
Yep.
And that actually was something that got significantly less attention in the media than Tukey Williams, but nonetheless a sort of landmark, if you want to call it that. Your thoughts on that?
In some ways, it's just another execution. There was nothing really magical about the number 1,000, nothing intrinsically significant about the number 1,000, and until a couple of days before it actually happened, it looked like actually number 1,000 was going to be a Virginia death row prisoner named Robin Lovett, who got a commutation at the last minute from the governor of Virginia because the state had disposed of the murder weapon, a pair of scissors, in that case, which, had it not been disposed of, could have provided DNA information that would have cleared Lovett. Boyd was in some ways typical, in some ways not typical. It brought back some fairly unpleasant memories for me because he was... Boyd was a Vietnam vet, came back from Vietnam. He drove a bulldozer, was sniped at almost every day that he was over there. And what it brought back to me was flashbacks of actually execution number 56, a Florida death row prisoner who I represented in 1986 named David Livingston Funchess, who was actually the first Vietnam veteran to be executed in the U.S. But milestones, you know, the 1,000th execution, the 2,000th American combat fatality in Iraq, don't really have intrinsic significance, it seems to me, but they do provide good teachable moments, sort of moments, an opportunity to go back and reflect on some of these larger questions. And 2005 actually was a milestone year in a number of different ways, in addition to the 1,000th execution.
Well, I want to bring things a little bit closer to home now and maybe talk about the death penalty in New Hampshire and also in Vermont. That I heard you say earlier that there is no death penalty statute in Vermont. Is that, did I hear that correctly?
There is no death penalty statute in Vermont, at least for the moment. The Vermont legislature all but abolished capital punishment in 1965. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated every state's death penalty statute in the U.S. in a magnificent constitutional earthquake of a case called Furman versus Georgia. And in the wake of Furman, 38 states have reinstated capital punishment, have enacted modern capital statutes, including New Hampshire, in, I think, 92 or 93. The Vermont legislature went the other way, actually. In 1987, the legislature abolished capital punishment, even though there really wasn't anything on the books to abolish. They just wanted to make clear that Vermont was a state that was not going to have the death penalty. And for a number of years now, we've been one of only 12 states that don't have capital punishment. In 2000, the year 2000, there was an especially hideous murder, actually a series of murders in Vermont. Two guys named Lee and Donnie Fell went on a rampage in the home in Vermont of Fell's mother and her companion. They killed both of them, escaped, hitchhiked to a Price Chopper supermarket in Rutland, Vermont, carjacked a woman named Tereska King at about 2 in the morning as Tereska King was arriving for work at the Price Chopper, carjacked her car, drove around 700 miles, I think, to Dutchess County, New York, and beat her to death by the side of the road as she was praying and pleading for her life. The state jurisdictions involved New York, state prosecutors and Vermont state prosecutors both decided, for sort of independent and pretty interesting reasons, actually, if you want to spend some time talking on this, but they decided to punt it to the feds, because under the federal carjacking statute, the federal prosecutors, the U.S. attorney in Vermont, could seek the death penalty. Problem was, the U.S. attorney in Vermont decided, recommended against seeking the death penalty. The case went to the Ashcroft Justice Department in D.C., who overruled the Vermont federal prosecutor and insisted on prosecuting the Fell case as a death penalty case. And the upshot of all that was that last July, July of 2005, a Vermont federal jury in Chittenden County in Burlington found Donnie Fell guilty of the federal crime of carjacking with death resulting and sentenced him to death, which in Vermont was, there hasn't been a capital trial, much less a death sentence in Vermont, in several generations of Vermont lawyers and judges. No one's been executed in Vermont since two killers went to the electric chair in 1954. The last time anyone was sentenced to death in Vermont was, I think, 1957, and that sentence was later commuted. And the last time anyone had even stood trial on capital charges in Vermont was 1962. So this has been a fairly unsettling set of circumstances here in Vermont. And it turns out that the Donnie Fell trial and the death sentence were probably just act one of this play. There is what, to all appearances at least, appears to be a very serious effort within the Vermont legislature to at least consider reinstating a state death penalty statute here. A relatively high-octane member of the Vermont House of Representatives, Duncan Kilmartin, has drafted a bill and is going to be introducing it probably on the first day of the Vermont legislative session. So the death penalty fireworks here really are just beginning. Stay tuned.
On this, the fireworks in New Hampshire have sort of died down, but a few years ago, of course, there was a pretty highly noted case in terms of trying to get our then-Governor Gene Shaheen to agree to get the rest of the death penalty that's still on the books off of there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We came so close in 2000. Both houses of the New Hampshire legislature, both Republican houses, Republican-controlled houses, of the New Hampshire legislature voted in a fairly lopsided, although not veto-proof way, to abolish capital punishment in Vermont, to repeal New Hampshire's state death penalty statute. It was, of course, vetoed by Democratic Governor Gene Shaheen, and it has, so far as I know, has been fairly, things have been pretty quiet there since then. I was invited to submit a statement to the New Hampshire legislature back in 2000, I think before the House Judiciary Committee, and there was a lot of hope and a lot of enthusiasm that New Hampshire might actually become the first state in the modern era of capital punishment since the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the boards back in 1972 with Furman v. Georgia to actually affirmatively abolish capital punishment, and we came within one vote of that, so close, but unfortunately the one vote was the governor. So New Hampshire still has an untested capital statute on the books. There's never been a capital prosecution under that statute that has resulted in a trial. There have been a couple of false starts, but they've both been resolved by guilty pleas before going to trial. But my hope is that as part of what seems to me, And this may just be wishful thinking on my part, but I think there's more to it than this. The rest of the country really seems to be reconsidering capital punishment in fundamental ways and is having a very serious, sophisticated, grown-up conversation about whether capital punishment is wise social policy, whether the benefits of capital punishment are worth the costs. And nothing would please me more than for the Vermont legislature to have a serious conversation, legislative hearings, bring in witnesses, really explore the issue in a serious way and in a comprehensive way in January of 2006, and then reject it resoundingly and for a generation. And the only thing that would make me happier than that would be if the New Hampshire legislature were then to follow suit and finally get rid of New Hampshire's capital punishment statute, which really is, it seems to me, mostly pointless. It has symbolic value, I suppose, but I'm not sure that it has much more than that.
You're listening to WSCALP 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm Tom Jackson, and for Joe Public Media, I am talking with Professor Michael Mello of Vermont Law School. He is a specialist on the death penalty. Mike, the death penalty is an issue that certainly draws some pretty strong opinions in people. Anytime that I've talked to folks about where they stand on the death penalty, I don't tend to get sort of wishy-washy answers. They're either very for it or very against it, it seems. Give us, from your perspective as a specialist on this issue, give us the basics of your best legal and moral arguments against the death penalty.
That's actually probably a harder question for me than it should be, because my opposition to capital punishment really isn't based on morality or religion or philosophy in a large sense. What I oppose is capital punishment as a legal system. It's a government operation. It's really the IRS with the power to kill you. And it should really come as no surprise that this particular government operation makes a lot of mistakes. And for me, the strongest argument against capital punishment as a legal system is the problem of innocence. No matter how hard we try, no matter how much money states are willing to pump into a criminal justice system, a capital punishment system, people make mistakes, and judges are people, juries are people, and by a very conservative estimate, there have been 122 exonerations under modern current capital punishment statutes. Now, 122 exonerations, there have now been 1,004 executions, which means that for roughly every 9 executions, there's been an exoneration. And I want to be clear about what I mean by exoneration. Someone who is absolutely, totally, 100% innocent. They got the wrong guy. They simply convicted and sentenced to death the wrong person. Has happened 122 times under these modern, relatively well-funded, well-financed capital punishment statutes. Issues of race and class, in my experience, also really can't be separated from capital punishment as a legal system, what I like to call the real capital punishment. Capital punishment as a legal system is hopelessly warped by matters of class, and at least in the South, which is where most of my experience with capital punishment has been, also warped by matters of race. Now, one could, and I think it's fair to characterize these concerns, innocence, class, race, and the like, as moral issues. It seems to me profoundly immoral to tolerate a system that we know has, will, and will always send innocent people to death row and execute them. It seems to me immoral to tolerate a system under which the decision of who lives and who dies is based not nearly so much as on the crime or is on the criminal, but is based on the quality of defense lawyering the person receives at trial and on appeal and in the state and federal post-conviction processes. Those seem to be moral argument against capital punishment. But in terms of what I think most folks think of as moral arguments opposing capital punishment, I have never heard or read a convincing moral, religious, philosophical argument against capital punishment. I'm not a pacifist, for example. I believe that the state, the government, has the right, and in certain limited circumstances, just wars, for example, the state has the moral obligation to kill in self-defense. And I haven't come up with a way of getting from that assumption to a conclusion that if the state can, consistent with morality, kill external enemies in self-defense, why that same state can't, with equal moral force, turn around and kill some of its own citizens in domestic self-defense.
Well, among the many arguments that I have heard from people who are against the death penalty. Another thing that seems to come up fairly often is they will say that it actually costs, in terms of financial costs, it costs the state more to execute someone than it does to keep them on death row. And because I admittedly don't know that much about it, I've wondered if that is a sort of folk myth, or is that really accurate? Do you know about that particular issue?
It is absolutely accurate. And going back to the statement that I submitted to the New Hampshire legislature 5 years ago, I focus really on only two issues, innocence and cost. And those two issues are very related in my mind, because the quality of justice that you get depends in large measure on how much money you're willing to put into it. There really aren't absolutely precise numbers on how much executions cost and how much versus how much life imprisonment without possibility of parole costs. But in general, study after study after study has found that capital punishment costs millions of dollars more per execution than life imprisonment without possibility of parole. For my money, the best study is one that's now a few years old. It was David Vondrelli did it in the Miami Herald newspaper back in, I think it was May of 1988, estimated $4.3 million more to execute a death row prisoner than it costs to incarcerate them for the rest of their lives. And there are a variety of reasons why that's the case. But for me, I think the bottom line is lawyers cost more than prison guards. And unless we are going to radically limit appeals, and which in turn would greatly increase the always present, omnipresent risk of executing the innocent, that's the connection in my mind between the cost issue and the innocence issue, you're going to get a fairly direct trade-off, it seems to me. So it's counterintuitive. And it's an issue, the cost issue is actually one that I'm kind of a latecomer in coming to. Cost was an issue that I never used to like talking about or making that argument, because it always felt weird to me to be making a dollar and cents argument when the issue on the table is whether my government ought to be in the business of killing people.
Right.
But when your audience is a legislature, especially a legislature like the Vermont legislature next month, or the New Hampshire legislature back in 2000, that's an audience that has got to take cost into consideration in a very big way. And I have always thought that if there was a way to document how much a capital prosecution, which went all the way and resulted in an actual execution in New Hampshire, would cost versus a guilty plea or even a non-capital trial, we would have been able to persuade even Jean Shaheen back in 2000 to sign the abolition bill. And those are probably going to be the two main arguments now that I'm going to be making in the Vermont legislature next month, the interconnected issues of innocence and cost, and the practical fiscal reality in states like Vermont and New Hampshire that don't have a lot of spare cash to be spending on symbolic programs. And the idea that the Vermont legislature would divert money, and we're talking a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars every year for as long as capital punishment stays on the books here. That's all money, dollar for dollar, you're taking away from heating subsidies for poor people, school funding, cops on the beat, prosecutors, investigators, DNA testing. I mean, once you really get into the actual, the nitty-gritty, the how much capital punishment costs at each step and each stage in the process, the practical argument for abolition or against reinstatement really becomes pretty powerful, it seems to me. And that's the case that I hope to help put on in Montpelier in the Vermont State House in January.
Do you see a day coming when the death penalty is abolished throughout the U.S., or do you think that that would involve enough of a cultural change? And by that I mean, a certain percentage of the population that occasionally we've been called a culture of violence or revenge. Is that something that just isn't likely to happen in the years to come?
There's no doubt in my mind that at some point America will join most of the rest of the world that we consider civilized and reject capital punishment. And in fact, I like a lot of the trend lines that I see on this issue. Public opinion is still majority in favor of capital punishment, but by smaller majorities than was the case even a few years ago. The high point, I think, was in the mid-90s, around 80%. It's now down to around 64%. And that 64%, if the only question you ask is, are you for or against capital punishment? Throw in life imprisonment without possibility of parole as an alternative, and the number drops below 50%. Death sentencing rates across the country have declined, and in some instances declined pretty dramatically over the past few years. One of the things that makes 2005, I think, a milestone year in capital punishment is the numbers came out in 2005 from death sentences in the year before, in 2004, and the numbers are dramatically down. Juries are much less willing to return death sentences today than they were even a few years ago. Numbers of executions haven't changed very much. There were 60 executions in 2005, 59 in 2004. But it's way too soon to conclude that America right now is on the path to abolition, that we've turned some sort of metaphorical corner, and that it's now only a matter of time. There are so many variables that come into play that we can't quantify, that we can't even really identify with anything close to scientific precision. But the sense that I get is that America's taking a step back from capital punishment. And really the only two exceptions have been, that I can see at least, have been the Ashcroft Justice Department and the federal death penalty, and the Vermont legislature taking up a capital punishment reinstatement bill in a serious way in January. I mean, ironically, right when the rest of the country seems to be stepping back from capital punishment and is reconsidering it, Vermont seems to be considering moving in the opposite direction.
Well, in the few minutes that we have remaining, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the resources that are out there for those who would like to read up some more on the death penalty debate and issue, including you have a number of books, Dead Wrong, A Death Row Lawyer Speaks Out Against Capital Punishment. What sort of reading would you recommend people do if they want to know some more about this issue?
The single best resource, I think, actually is the Death Penalty Information Center website, which I think is deathpenaltyinfo.org. They really have become the leading collector of empirical information about capital punishment. And they just published their death penalty in 2005 year-end report that gives all the numbers and the statistical breakdowns. There are literally scores of really first-rate books about every aspect of capital punishment. My two favorites, I think, are David Vondrely's 1995 book, Among the Lowest of the Dead, which focuses on Florida as a case study in America's modern experience with capital punishment. And the other book I would recommend is actually a novel called Conviction by Richard North Patterson that really does a wonderful job of evaluating and describing the process and the obstacles faced by death row lawyers, even when we are trying to raise claims of actual innocence, of factual innocence. The Richard North Patterson book, Conviction, has a chillingly accurate and profoundly depressingly accurate account of the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which, for all intents and purposes, shut down federal judicial review, federal habeas corpus review for large classes and categories of death row claims, including claims of factual innocence.
I would like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've written as well. Another one of those books being The Wrong Man, A True Story of Innocence on Death Row, about Crazy Joe Spaziano. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular one?
Crazy Joe Spaziano was my one client over the years who I absolutely knew with 100% certainty. I knew in my bone marrow that he was innocent. He, as it turned out, was my first capital client when I first started working as a capital public defender in Florida. His was the first case file that my boss walked into my office and plopped down on my desk my first day of work. And I ended up representing him on and off from then, the fall of 1983 until actually the fall of 1995, when he came within just a few days of being executed for crimes that I know he didn't commit. And it wasn't anything that I did as his lawyer or that the courts did that saved his life in 1995. It rather was the intervention of a strongly pro-capital punishment newspaper, the Miami Herald, who jumped into his case, did a bit of investigative reporting, and was able to persuade the state's star witness to finally, after at that time close to 20 years, turning around and telling the truth. And it was, I mentioned a moment ago when I was talking about the Richard North Patterson book, that one of the things I liked about that book was it shows the obstacles that defense lawyers confront when they're trying to persuade courts to really take a look at and consider newly discovered evidence of innocence. And in Joe's case, back in 95, it actually took a little act of civil disobedience on my part to nudge the Florida Supreme Court into granting a stay of execution to give us enough time to put on an evidentiary hearing before a Florida trial judge on or newly discovered evidence of innocence, which really was the Miami Herald's newly discovered evidence of innocence, which when we finally had the opportunity to do that, the judge threw out the conviction, threw out the death sentence, and unfortunately, Joe is still in prison. He's not on death row, but he's still in prison on an unrelated rape charge, unrelated rape conviction, which it turns out the state of Florida used the same perjurious witness, the same lying witness, to frame him for the rape case as they used to frame him for the murder case and send him to death row for nearly two decades and five death warrants. So this time every year, actually, every Hanukkah and Christmas and New Year's, I write Joe a letter, and I've been doing this since 1983. I send him a letter, the thrust of which is, hopefully next year, my friend, will be the year that we'll be able to walk you out of Florida State Prison a free man. But we're not quite there yet.
And again, the name of that book by Michael Mello about Crazy Joe Spaziano is The Wrong Man, A True Story of Innocence on Death Row. A couple of others that he has written, Dead Wrong, A Death Row Lawyer Speaks Out Against Capital Punishment, and Death Work, Defending the Condemned. Michael Mello is a professor of law at Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. Professor Mello, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Anytime. It was great chatting with you.